And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Visit DirecTV.com. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
This is The Athletic Baseball Show on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Athletic Baseball Show presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70, celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. It is Monday, October 4th. 162 games are in the books. And the final day of the regular season brought plenty of drama for us, Ken. We entered the day wondering if we might get a four-way tie for two wildcard spots in the American League. It didn't play out that way, but it was a fun day of baseball nonetheless.
It was an amazing day, and of course, for a lot of the day, we didn't know that we were going to avoid chaos. The Yankees were 0-0 into the ninth, the Red Sox were down 5-1, Sale only pitched a couple of innings, J.D. Martinez leaves the game with an injury. You're thinking, oh my gosh, the Blue Jays routed the Orioles, here we go. But didn't turn out that way. It turned out actually the simplest way that it could have, which was with the Yankees and Red Sox needing to win to get in. They won. Ultimately. So where are we overall? Obviously, we've got a great pair of wild card games coming up. And when I say great, maybe the best ever pair. The reason I say that, we've got a 106 win Dodger team that is going to face the St. Louis Cardinals with their ageless battery of Adam Wainwright and Yadier Molina. The Cardinals, a team that won 17 games in a row in September to get to this point. And then we have the ancient rivals, the Yankees and Red Sox, squaring off in the American League game. Actually, that one will come first, of course, Tuesday night. And those teams kind of both staggered in, but they're in. And it's Eovaldi and Cole. It's going to be amazing. And I'm really looking forward to this entire postseason. The other two series that are set are going to be fascinating as well. Astros, White Sox, Baker and La Russa, reviving their ancient feud. And that's going to be something to watch. Two terrific teams. And the Braves and Brewers, that one, Derek, I actually believe is more even than the average person might think because the Braves have played so well since the trade deadline. Fried and Morton are both as hot as Burns and Woodruff, if not hotter. So we have a great October ahead of us. And what a day Sunday was. And I don't know that we can begin without paying proper tribute to the Giants. One of the great regular season teams in recent memory. 107 wins. That's the most wins by a National League team since the 1986 Mets. And keep in mind, the Dodgers made the big trade at the deadline, the trade that might go down as one of the best in deadline history. After that trade, they went 44-13. 44-13. From July 31st on, they gained only two games on the Giants, who went 43-16. That is amazing. And I'll quote Andrew Baggerly again from The Athletic, what he said, I don't know, last week or a week and a half ago. They were getting chased, the Giants were, by Usain Bolt, and they did not cede any ground. It was amazing to me. That was really one of the great accomplishments of any season, the way they stood tall and held off what might be a team that's going to be favored to win the World Series regardless. Hats off to the Giants.
The Dodgers kept the heat on the entire time. I mean, they throughout the weekend kept winning big, kept the Giants in the position to have to win on Sunday to clinch the division. A huge difference, of course, playing in the wild card game versus not playing in the wild card game. The thing that surprises me every time I look at this leaderboard, Ken, the Giants offense is the best offense in the National League in terms of WRC+, in terms of home runs across all of Major League Baseball. They finished second, 240 home runs. Only the Blue Jays hit more home runs than the Giants. When you think about the makeup of that team, the way that Oracle Park has traditionally played, it is jarring to see a Giants team that is that good offensively.
Derek, you're absolutely right. And on the flip side of the coin in the American League, the Rays are kind of their twin offensively. It's not a team that you would expect would be at the top or near the top of the rankings, and yet they are. So these two teams are perhaps the most or the best constructed teams in both leagues. Can't really say the Dodgers aren't there with them. But whether that holds in the playoffs, we don't know, because the playoffs are an entirely different thing. I am still skeptical of the Giants in the playoffs because of their starting pitching. I don't see it quite as dominant as some others. But you know what? We doubted them, what, for 6 months now? I think it's probably time to stop doubting them.
I think they still have that chip on their shoulder, too, because they hear it. They know. They know how people feel about them and what people think of them. And you still have veterans from the last World Series team as holdovers. I think any team that has that playoff experience, it's hard to quantify what that means, but it means something, even if it's only a little something on the margins. And I think what's going to be really interesting with the Giants to me, you know, Kevin Gausman, Logan Webb as a 1-2, I think they hold up reasonably well against other teams. 1-2 at the top. It's where you get down to Desclafani and Alex Wood. How far can those guys go against the best of the best lineups throughout October? And then if you push relievers into the game early, you do have a lot of inexperienced relievers that you're going to be relying on in that Giants bullpen. So I think that's going to be a big part of whether they're able to make a deep run or not, is how 3 and 4 fare in the rotation and Desclafani and Wood, and then how the bullpen, like the non-high leverage bullpen arms, how they fare when they're called upon.
Very fair. And their bullpen has been exhausted down the stretch, so they need this little break here. And one other thing to keep in mind, should the Cardinals win the wild card game, then that starting pitching advantage that we're talking about is mitigated, right? Their starting pitching is certainly as impressive, or much more impressive than the Cardinals, I would think. And even against the Dodgers, the biggest difference is Scherzer and Buehler have done this. They've done it repeatedly. Gausman and Logan Webb in particular have not. And that's something that comes into play. We all know that here, potentially. But if Gausman can be what he was in the first half, and he showed signs of that recently, and if Webb can sustain what he has done second half, hey, it's a good point. Their 1-2 is as good as anyone. But man, Scherzer and Buehler, the potential of them to get there. Now, I know Scherzer would be pushed back in the division series. That would hurt, but that's going to be something to see if we get to that. And I'm not dismissing the Cardinals upsetting the Dodgers in that game.
Very much a possibility in that game on Wednesday. I think that White Sox-Astros series that you were talking about, that starts on Thursday in Houston, that is going to be fantastic, because the White Sox are one of those teams, they match up with the best of the best of anybody. They're good at the top of the rotation. They have a strong lineup top to bottom. The bullpen is nasty, but it's also a deep bullpen. If they get into trouble with any of their starters, they can lean pretty heavily on their relievers and have a chance of keeping even an elite offense like Houston relatively quiet. But Houston has all the same strengths that they always have. So that could be really, I could see that series easily going 5 and coming down to the very last outs of game 5 before that series is won.
Well, Derek, I'm working on a postseason preview kind of column right now. It's basically top 10 storyline, something like that. And I've got La Russa and Baker as one. And I think, I'm not sure yet, I'm going to do the White Sox as a boom and bust as another, because they are capable of marching to the World Series and winning it. They are that talented, that good. At the same time, they are a flawed team. They are not a team that, in the words of one rival manager, does very well at winning on the margins. Not a good defensive team. Not good holding runners. Not good behind the plate as far as wild pitches and pass balls are concerned. They are a team that has to be hot offensively, and certainly they can get as hot as any. And the Astros, I question their bullpen. Even after all that they did at the deadline, I don't know if their low leverage guys are capable of holding up here, and even their high leverage guys. So this should be a fascinating series in any number of ways. And yeah, I'm looking forward to that one as well. I'm going to be on the Tampa Bay whoever series for Fox. And then if the ALCS ends up with one of those teams, I'll be there, obviously.
Yeah, the Rays anxiously awaiting to see which AL East opponent they're going to catch in the ALDS. It's going to be a blast watching these games throughout the week. Anything else that really caught your eye on the final days of the season? I mean, the Dodgers, Clayton Kershaw went down with a forearm injury over the weekend. Max Muncy suffered an injury on Sunday. It looks like that's going to cost him some significant amount of time. It just seems like there's been a few things kind of suddenly going wrong for the Dodgers here in the final weekend.
Agreed. And they always are praised, rightly so, as perhaps the deepest team, along with Tampa Bay. But they build depth, right? They had that amazing deep starting rotation going into the season. Well, of that group, it's really only Buehler and Urias that are left. And the Muncy injury, first of all, it's really tough to watch that happen. And I hate when this happens at the end of a season because you want to see the Dodgers at their best, both with Kershaw and Muncy. You want to see the Giants at their best, and they've lost Belt. So certainly that is something to keep our eyes on. The other thing that caught my eye was the Urshela play, the dive into the Tampa Bay dugout. That was an incredible play. It showed all kinds of skill, for one, just to make that play, coming from where he did in the shift, that distance, and then the toughness to remain in the game after just careening into the dugout. Raised echoes of Derek Jeter way back when in that Sunday night game against the Red Sox. And my goodness, that was just something else. And that's one we'll remember for sure.
Yeah, Yankees are a little bit thinner on the infield, too, with the report that DJ LeMahieu...
on the IL.
Yeah, he's on the IL. So it's a big deal to be a key player down this time of year. But several teams, of course, dealing with it, as is always the case.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
When you get injured, you don't want to wait for answers and options. That's why it may be time to explore the Nano Experience, a revolutionary treatment option designed to help active people get back to the lifestyles they love. Nanotechnology allows surgeons to see inside even the smallest joints and treat orthopedic conditions with a tiny camera and other nano instrumentation, all through a barely there poke hole incision. Wherever you've experienced an injury, whether it be a foot and ankle, hand and wrist, shoulder and elbow, knee or hip, nanoarthroscopy can be used to diagnose and treat your condition in an extremely, minimally invasive way. Don't wait to learn about the revolutionary Nano Experience and how it could help you or someone you know after an injury. Visit arthrex.info/theathletic. This is not medical advice and is not meant to be a substitute for advice from your physician. Talk with your physician about your health condition, potential surgical risks, and whether Arthrex products are right for you. Postoperative management is patient-specific and dependent upon your physician's assessment. Individual results will vary. Let's go to the mailbag.
Hey, this is Ken.
I'm not available right now. Please leave a voicemail.
Keep those questions coming throughout the playoffs. We'll keep trying to answer them. There are two ways to reach the show. You can call us at 646-543-7072. You can also email us at tabaseballshow@gmail.com. We got a question here about what happens to the wild cards and seedings. This question comes from Scott in Vancouver, and he's wondering, what do you think of the idea that the two division winners with the best records still retain home field, but seeding and scheduling of the divisional series is on hold until after the wild card games have been played? Then the team with the worst record, whether that's a wild card winner or a divisional winner, plays the team with the best record, and the two middle teams play against each other. So what do you think about this as a variation of the current playoff seeding arrangement, Ken?
I like it, Scott. And keep in mind, anything we discuss here is likely to be adjusted in the new CBA anyway. I'm expecting MLB to push for expanded playoffs. Not necessarily expecting the union to embrace the idea, but maybe trade it off for something that they want. So I would not be surprised if this is the last year of this format. That said, for the sake of discussion, let's say this format continues and we continue with 10 teams in the current way. Yes, reseeding would be helpful. And the reason is to avoid what we're going to have this year, which is the potential for a Dodgers-Giants best of five instead of a best of seven in the league championship series. That just doesn't sit right with anyone. And when you have a 107-win team and a 106-win team, you want them in the maximum number of games, not the minimum number. So that's one issue. Of course, people can say, well, a 106-win team like the Dodgers shouldn't even have to play in a wild card game, but that's the way the sport is set up, to honor the division winners. I have no problem with that. But I would like to see, under the present format, this kind of reseeding. Now, I must say, in the American League, it would not have been a problem. We would have seen it properly. We're going to see it properly, actually. The Rays have the best record. They're going to face the wild card team, which is the Yankees or the Red Sox. And the second and third best records will play. But in some years, in some circumstances, yes, it would be appropriate to have it seeded. And I see no reason why, if this format holds, baseball would not adjust that going forward.
I also like the idea of the team with the better record choosing their opponent. I kind of like the drama that comes from that, because you might feel you match up better with one team that's the third best based on record, right? If you have the top seed, you should have your choice of who you get to play.
It's true, and that is an intriguing idea. And remember, in that original 14-team proposal that baseball laid out, there was this aspect of it that was basically a televised drama of the teams picking their opponents. And maybe that comes to pass. That would be kind of cool.
Yeah, like extra drama like that. Also, just kind of fun to see how often you'd take a team that is not the worst record team of the bunch. Thanks a lot for that question, Scott. Our next question comes from Kyle. Kyle's a Phillies fan, been watching them for the past few years. There's been a continual lack of talent throughout the entire system and farm system. Every offseason and trade deadline, the same question comes up about how do they bring in talent to bolster the roster, and it's the same answer. There's nothing to do but draft better. Going through this, then hearing about the ambitions of adding teams has me wondering, how is it possible to add additional teams with quality talent when there is already a dearth of pitching and defense in the league? With Major League Baseball considering expansion teams, do they also consider restructuring the minor leagues and working more closely with the NCAA and college programs to help with developing talent? Thanks, Kyle.
Kyle, you're throwing a lot at me there. And I'll start with the fact, or my opinion, I should say, that baseball does not have a talent problem. The Phillies have a talent problem, but baseball in general does not have a talent problem. And in fact, baseball is drawing talent from more places than ever before. The talent in the sport probably has never been greater than ever before. And yes, the sport could withstand the additions of two teams, which could come, I guess, by the end of this decade. Granted, yes, there's always pitchers or a lack of pitching depth. That's true. But I don't know that the way to solve that is through a restructuring of the minor leagues. Maybe it's by changing some rules to enhance starting pitching, which we'll get to later. And maybe it's also just emphasizing different things in development. Those are all possibilities. Now, the NCAA question is a good one. College teams are allowed only 11.7 baseball scholarships. That's compared to 85 for football. 11.7 versus 85. Now, why? Revenue is why. We all know that. There have been times over the years when baseball has talked about funding more scholarships. I don't know where that stands right now. It certainly is an idea that would make it easier for players to attend college and perhaps develop their skills better that way. The minor league restructuring that has taken place, the motive for that was not to enhance talent development, though that is perhaps an effect of that, or an indirect result of that. Basically, the idea was to become more efficient and run the minor leagues more efficiently and in a better way. By doing that, yes, it might enhance the development of talent, but I don't know that that was the main goal. So again, to sum it up, all of these things you mentioned are valid and worth exploring, and the sport is exploring them to varying extents. But again, I don't believe there's a talent problem. Maybe with individual teams, yes, but with the sport in general, no.
Yeah, I would say right now we're finding organizations that are developing pitching and turning guys that were not expected to be impactful big league pitchers either into either quality starters or at least high leverage relievers at a greater clip than in the past. That makes things really interesting from a development standpoint. So I'm with you, Ken. I don't think we're at a point where there's a talent problem in the league. I think Kyle's just experiencing unique Philly problems with the Phillies, and I'd be frustrated too if I were a fan of that team.
And Derek, one more point on this. There is more development and better development in some ways than ever before, as you just mentioned. That's a great point. Now, I question what they're developing at times, the things that they're emphasizing, power, both offensively and from a pitching standpoint, but the teaching, the data that's available, all of the different things that take place now, it's better than before. It's just, where do you want to put your emphasis?
Absolutely. Now, you mentioned there is a related question here. This one comes from Steve. He writes, there's been a lot of talk about improving not just the pace of play, but also creating more action on the field. Has there been any talk of requiring starting pitchers to stay in games longer? Keeping starters on the mound longer would reduce strikeouts and increase offense for several reasons. Fewer relievers, fewer max effort deliveries, more starters seeing a lineup three times. Could a rule requiring starting pitchers to throw 90 pitches, six innings, or give up six runs gain any traction? With this rule, the disincentive to pull a starter early would be an automatic 10-day IL stint. Thanks for taking my question. And that's Steve from Washington.
Steve, I don't know that there'll ever be that kind of innings idea implemented, but the point you raise is a really good one. And in fact, it came up on our Fox broadcast Saturday night. John Smoltz, who, as you might expect, is an advocate for starting pitching, said that he was a fan of the rule that's being tried in the Atlantic League this year, in which a team loses its DH the moment it removes its starting pitcher. So therefore, there is greater incentive for a team to keep its starting pitcher in the game and go about it that way. There has also been talk of reducing the size of pitching staffs, which also would force pitchers to stay in games longer. I don't know that I'm in favor of one rule over the other, but I'm in favor of the concept. And the reason I'm in favor of the concept is because the starting pitcher is a huge part of what attracts us to this game. When you know that Scherzer is facing DeGrom, as one example, you're excited. And we've lost that a little bit in recent years with the onset of bullpenning and just the different ways pitchers are used. I don't blame the clubs. They're doing what they think is best to win, but it would behoove the sport, from a fan perspective, to make it more starting pitcher friendly. And I think there are ways to do that. The double hook rule, which is actually something Jason Stark suggested, the one we just talked about, the DH being removed the moment the starting pitcher is out of the game, that would be one way to do it. The reduction in size of the staff would be another way. I'd like to see one, both, all of the above. Because to me, the starting pitcher should be the essence of this sport, and we've lost that a little bit.
Yeah, I think one other way you could tweak the rules without changing something about how pitchers are used in game would be changing some of the rules about minor league options and how you can get players on and off the roster, because it seems like the roster management that teams do now to use the AAA depth more effectively, that's also enabled bullpenning a bit more, aside from actually expanding the roster slightly themselves, right? Like, that seems like the kind of thing where if you have some sort of penalty, some sort of disincentive, some way to make it a little more difficult to shuttle players up and down, maybe you can reduce some of the games that are pure bullpen games or at least high volume reliever games.
Derek, great point. And certainly that is something that teams exploit, take advantage of, abuse, and adjusting that would help along the same lines.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks a lot for that question, Steve. Got another question here from Ian. I was hoping you could talk about how you weigh offense and defensive contributions from a player when voting for MVP. In part, I ask this because neither Bryce Harper nor Fernando Tatis Jr. strike me as top defensive players. From a stats perspective, how many players have won the Gold Glove and Silver Slugger, but not the MVP? And is this why catcher, second base, and shortstop are the positions with the fewest MVPs, especially when you look at the last 30 years?
I don't have all those answers in front of me, but defense is something that I weigh. This year, with the National League race, Harper, Soto, Tatis, none of those players is a defensive difference maker, in my opinion. In fact, Harper and Tatis were toward the bottom of their positions, at least in defensive runs saved. Now, the defensive metrics can vary. Some players look better under some metrics than others, but neither one of those guys, it's safe to say, is an impact defender. Soto was actually pretty good in right field this year, according to defensive runs saved above average. But is that enough for me or anyone else to say, wow, that's my deciding factor in the MVP voting? He's not Frank Robinson out there. He's good. He's gotten better, but he's not that good. Now, the point you raise about the value of defense in an MVP vote, as you suggested, past votes indicate that we don't value it very much. Why do I say that? Because first basemen have won the most MVPs, and catchers, second basemen, and shortstops, the least. So, with catchers, you've only seen two MVPs since Pudge Rodriguez in 1999. That would be Maurer in 2009 and Buster Posey in 2012. We've seen second basemen win recently, Altuve in 2017, Pedroia 2008. Last shortstops to win, interestingly enough, two in 1 year, A-Rod and J-Roll, Jimmy Rollins, in 2007. So maybe you're right, and maybe we do need to value defense more, and maybe Brandon Crawford of the Giants is a better candidate than we're giving him credit for. But for the most part, voters look at the offense first. That's where players can make, in most cases, their biggest impact. And that's where the discussion starts. Perhaps we need to take a harder look at it. And in fact, the criteria list offense and defense, the value to a player's team, as the number one thing, offense and defense. So it's certainly something that we should be looking at closely.
Yeah, I think you're beginning to answer the next question that we received. This one came from Dan Z in Ohio. He writes, Ken, loved your explanation and clarification of the Hall of Fame voting criteria. Now I have a question on another vote, the MVP. You went over what voters for the Hall are told to consider, but what are MVP voters asked to consider?
Well, actually, it's pretty clear instructions that we receive and mostly ignore. The instructions say, they list five criteria. I'll go through them one by one. Number one, actual value of a player to his team. That is strength of offense and defense. That's what I just said. Number two, number of games played. And you've heard me talk on TV and on this podcast about how I strongly consider that. I think number of games played is a deciding factor and can be in this kind of vote. Number three, general character, disposition, loyalty, and effort. And that's, of course, a subjective thing. Number four, former winners are eligible. And number five, members of more than one team can be voted on by a voter. So, yes, I could vote for Max Scherzer, Trey Turner, Max Muncy, any number of Dodgers I wanted to, if that's the way I wanted to go. So, again, this is a subjective vote. If it was best player, it would be less subjective. But because it's most valuable, voters generally do kind of apply their own standards to it. And I have no problem with that, but those are the basic instructions. Those are the things we should be looking at if we're paying attention to the rules at all.
It's weird that people would be given a set of rules and ignore them. You know, that never happens. Come on.
Right.
Happens everywhere. All the time. Thanks a lot for that question. We had one more that came in related to awards. I love when the questions fit together. That is actually sometimes a very fortunate sort of coincidence, not just something that we pull the questions just to make them all fit together. I guess that means the listeners are on the same page. But the question here comes from Bobby, and he's asking about your stated preference for Zach Wheeler over Corbin Burnes as part of the NL Cy Young conversation that we had last week. And he says, let's start with the premise that if Wheeler and Burnes have the same total of innings, because there's a gap between them, if they have the same total of innings pitched, ERA, whip, strikeouts, walks, home runs, the decision would be a coin flip. And for this to happen, based on each pitcher's current numbers, Corbin Burnes would have had to have pitched to a 4.79 ERA, a 1.36 whip, and carried a very low strikeout rate for an additional 40 innings to then equal Wheeler in those categories. So is it reasonable to think that adding these very bad hypothetical innings to Burnes should make him a better NL Cy Young Award candidate? We're talking about two guys who do have a disparity in workload.
I don't see it that way, and I'll explain why. So one thing that factors in here is the number of batters Wheeler has faced after the sixth inning. It's many more than Burnes or any of the other candidates. He's got 121, Burnes 45. That's 80 difference. Scherzer's at 58, Wheeler's at 69. So Wheeler, because his team was worse his bullpen was bad, was stretched out further than the other starters were. That's why he has the most innings. That is why he has a higher ERA, because in those 7 to 9 innings, or that area of the game, he's not going to be as effective, and he wasn't as effective. So when you look at the ERAs 1 through 6, yeah, he stacks up really well. Now, Craig Counsell of the Brewers, the manager, made a good point on Saturday, and he's very accurate in saying this. He says that Burns should not be penalized because of the way the Brewers used him. Well, he's right. The Brewers used Burns every sixth day, not every fifth day. They had a six-man rotation. And that is one reason he has fewer innings. Another reason is because he missed two starts after testing positive for COVID-19, later admitted he wasn't vaccinated. I know vaccinated players also had to miss time for COVID, but he wasn't vaccinated. He missed two starts for testing positive. That's part of the story here. So in the end, I do think Burns is going to win, and I will have no problem with him winning because of the historic nature of his season. But I am at least glad and gratified that the discussion around Wheeler has been more active in recent days. And people are saying, yeah, this is a disparity that we need to look at. Because in my view, the innings still do matter, whatever the reason. And yes, it's not Corbin Burns' fault. He was pitching in a six-man rotation. And perhaps that helped keep him healthy and help the team. And that was the best thing for the Brewers. That said, I would have no problem for anyone who votes Zach Wheeler first because of all the reasons I've stated.
Yeah, both have had outstanding seasons. And I think it's unfair when a player has a legitimate award-winning caliber year on a non-playoff team and it gets dismissed because the team didn't play into the postseason. It should not work that way, I think, as you and I have talked about on this show before.
Certainly not in Cy Young. That's best pitcher, period.
Yeah, absolutely.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Visit DirecTV.com. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Guys tend to think looking sharp means starchy Oxfords and stiff chinos rather than effortless comfort, but it's possible to have it both ways. I'm all set for summer thanks to Mack Weldon. The Vesper polo shirt is so breathable you can wear it on the golf course, but it looks classy enough to wear to a party. The Maverick Tech chino short is ultra flexible, and the Pima crew neck t-shirt is perfect for those casual weekends. There's no need to be uncomfortable in your clothing ever again. Some guys just want to look good without calling attention to themselves. Mack Weldon apparel gives you understated good looks for understated confidence. Mack Weldon clothes are designed to fit your style and the demands of modern life. They look like regular clothes, but feel like the latest in modern comfort. They're the go-to choice for guys who want to look great without even trying. Breathable underwear that keeps you cool, dry, and comfy all day. Crazy comfortable but elevated sweatpants. An upgraded classic polo with antimicrobial silver threads. An ultra-soft antimicrobial tee for when you need to stay fresh longer. That's the Silver Crew Neck T-shirt. Get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code MLBSHOW. That's MackWeldon.com. Promo code MLB Show.
Let's go to the voicemail for our next question here.
Hi, Ken. Second time caller and a big fan of the show. I was hoping to get your take on something that I'd understand if you'd rather not address. MLB and the MLB channel seem to have embraced gambling. I know it's legal, but I'm of an age that grew up being taught that bad things happen when baseball and gambling mix. To be honest, I'm not sure how I feel about it. It just seems weird. I'd like to get your take on it. Also, what are the odds now of Pete Rose getting into the Hall of Fame? Thanks.
Fair questions. I'm more than happy to tackle them. They're fair. Now, Pete Rose, first of all, he's not getting into the Hall of Fame. It's not because of the writers. It's baseball that has put him on the permanent ineligible list because he bet on the game. That is still a cardinal sin. Bet on his team. You can't do that. The rules are very clear on that. That's not going to change, even with the advent of gambling as we've seen it. Now, Let's go back a little bit. There was a Supreme Court ruling in 2018. It paved the way for sports betting to happen. It kind of struck down the ban on sports betting, and now different states have moved at different paces to embrace it. And with the technology we have today, it's certainly easy to implement. And let's face it, the sports leagues, and it's all of them, not just Major League Baseball, every single professional sports league and college sports to some extent too, want the revenue that gambling can provide. And let's not forget, The Athletic as well. Our publication has a partnership with BetMGM, and we've got plenty of sports betting content. So there's not one entity you can single out as saying, huh, they're more pure. No, we're all kind of in it together. Mm-hmm. The reason is clearly money. Now, how do I feel about it? That's a complicated question because I understand why this is happening. And I've always been of the opinion, however we can get people to enjoy the sport, whether it's fantasy baseball, whether it's gambling, whether it's as a casual fan, just rooting for your hometown team, there are many ways to enjoy baseball, and we should be open to all of them. But yes, I agree. The word you said is weird, and that word strikes me as proper in this case. I've been on MLB Network when we've had discussions of prop bets and will this guy get 3.5 total bases tonight and stuff like that. To me, it's essentially harmless, but it's kind of not what I was trained to do or entered the business to do or even want to do. But it's part of the equation. So we've got it at The Athletic. Major League Baseball's got it. Everyone's got it. I don't know that it changes anything for Pete Rose. It doesn't, in my mind, and it won't. But if a listener or reader of a certain age tells me that it makes them feel a little weird, squeamish, I can totally understand that. I'm with them.
Yeah, I mean, my background, I'm not traditionally a journalist. My background is from the fantasy sports world. And for years when I started working full-time at a company called RotoWire in 2006. The line was always, fantasy sports is not gambling. And that never sat right with me either, because if you play in a fantasy league, you put in $20 or $100, what do you put in for the season? You don't always get it back. You're putting money out there and you might come back with zero. You may win your league. You may come back with something. But to me, like from a fundamental standpoint, anytime there's a risk of losing something you put into something, that's a gamble. Therefore, it is gambling. At the same time, my brain works in numbers and props and all these things. So I'm not as bothered by it as some people might be. It is weird given how baseball was for me growing up. Ken, do you think this is also the kind of thing that is different now? Because back in the 70s, especially back in that era, player salaries were nothing close to what they are today. And the likelihood of negative influences acting upon players to get them to throw a game, for example, those things were so much more likely to happen in that era than they would be to happen today because of just how players are compensated. It's wildly different than that era.
It's a great point. I would agree with that. Now, the gambling that we have today presents the possibility for very big money, and you could conceivably tempt a young player, I would guess. But your point is still well taken, Derek. It's different. And the Black Sox in 1919, those guys were vulnerable to bribes because they weren't making much money. So that's one aspect of it. And it's interesting hearing your background and your discussion of that. Part of this is generational. I would think, a lot older than you, and I come from a time where this was much frowned upon. And to me, younger people have grown up playing fantasy in a big way. I don't know that they see the distinction and the problem that maybe an older person would. And that's fine. That's the way the world works. Things change. And again, I understand all sides of this. It's just a different variation of what we've done before.
But it is weird based on everything we saw and heard around gambling and baseball growing up to see the prevalence of gambling on the network at this point. Thanks a lot for that question. Let's go to this one from Adam. He wants to know, will Carlos Beltran get another shot at managing, and who are some other current and former players you could see as skippers?
I don't know if Beltran will be back as a manager. And it's a little bit odd that we have not heard from him at all since the Mets dismissed him in the wake of the Astros cheating scandal. AJ Hinch is managing. Alex Cora is managing. Of course, they were successful managers beforehand. Beltran was not a manager at all. But Beltran has not said anything. He is not working again for a team. I don't know what his intentions are. Now, I imagine there might be some Astros fans out there listening and saying, well, Ken, you and Evan wrote the story saying Beltran pressured everybody into this. Well, what we did report was that he and Alex Cora were two of the masterminds behind the trash can banging system. And we wrote a separate story later saying that Beltran and the influence he had in the clubhouse deterred others from stepping forward and saying stop. Now, in the wake of that story, some people at other outlets wrote and reported and talked about how we reported that he bullied players. That was never said. Was there pressure in the eyes of certain players? Yes, there was pressure, maybe implicit pressure, but a guy like Beltran has a certain place in the clubhouse and people look up to him and follow him. That's the reality of it. What he feels about all this, again, I don't know. Do I want to see Carlos Beltran back in the game? Yes, I do. He has something to offer the game, just as Alex Cora does, just as AJ Hinch does. And people might say, those guys should have been out of the game permanently. I disagree. They serve their punishment. That's the way baseball works. Whether it's with drug cheats or competitive cheats, you serve your time. That's it. You return to the sport. That's the way it should be, frankly. So I do hope Beltran comes back one day. I don't know exactly, again, where that stands. As for current players who could manage, I'm sure there's a bunch. I'd have to give this some thought. But there are a lot of smart guys in the game. And I am quite certain that some of them will end up doing that job.
I find manager to be one of those strange jobs where you don't necessarily have to work your way up at lower levels anymore. That's almost gone completely, right? The Mike Schilt approach or the Brian Snitker path to becoming a major league manager, that's actually more of an outlier. Usually it's a former player making the leap pretty soon after his career ends, actually becoming the new people who get opportunities in that role.
Well, it's interesting because we have seen that trend in recent years. Aaron Boone was one such manager, David Ross. We could name a bunch of others too. But we may see this swing back a little bit now. The Padres with Jace Tingler. He's expected to be gone perhaps by the time you're listening to this. Luis Rojas with the Mets, the same. Now, Luis managed in the minor leagues, did kind of work his way up, but was a first-time manager with a big market team. Both those teams are probably going to look for more experienced guys. And the success of La Russa and Baker, you can argue the impact, but that's going to help. And I would not be surprised if Bruce Bochy is working again next year. I would not be surprised to see some other older types get back in the mix, simply because there is value to experience. And I think in this sport, we have dismissed that in scouting. We have dismissed it in player development. The new is always better in baseball. And I guess in many other aspects of society as well. And that's not always the case, period. And some of the great minds in our game have been weeded out with this rush to have others involved. And in some ways, that's been really good. We've gotten new minds in the game, different ways of thinking. That's very healthy. But there's room for a lot of different perspectives, and that's been lost a little bit.
Yeah, I think we're going to continue to see more of a balance than we were. We're seeing a trend previously of first-time managers getting those opportunities, but I'm with you. I think we're going to see a few former managers who were not managing this year end up in some prominent spots, especially with some higher-profile opportunities available this offseason. One last question came in from Noah in Pittsburgh. He wanted to know what the offseason plans were for this show, and the good news is we're going to be here throughout October. That's awesome, right? I mean, that's exactly what everybody wants.
Yeah, and I would imagine past October we'll be doing it too, because the offseason is when people are maybe in some ways most interested in baseball. But yes, we do plan to continue the show through October. I'll be doing it from parts unknown, but I'll be doing it, and I look forward to it. And certainly I love the postseason, look forward to it. It's an exhausting time and exhilarating time. During the postseason, I work on the broadcast, obviously. Then I generally write after every game. We travel. It's kind of a crazy existence, but I wouldn't trade it for the world. And there's a zillion people, I'm sure, who would love to do it as well. So I look forward to it every year. This will be my 16th postseason for Fox, and I cherish each one.
That's awesome. Yeah, we're going to keep the show running all the way through the off season on the regular schedule through October. So keep the questions coming. Go to an off season schedule, November, December, but still going to have new episodes coming out a couple times each week. There are two ways to reach the show. If you'd like to drop a question for a future week, leave us a voicemail, 646-543-7072. You can also leave us an email, tabaseballshow@gmail.com. And if you want some day-to-day baseball talk, in the form of a live stream, we're going to have those starting Tuesday. The Rates and Barrels podcast goes live every morning at 11:30 a.m. Eastern, 8:30 a.m. Pacific. That is myself, along with Eno Saris and Britt Giroli. I'm sure we'll have guests on, too.
Ooh, very cool.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. Live on YouTube, podcast version goes up everywhere you listen to podcasts. So looking forward to doing that show each and every day. A little grateful, actually, we don't have the chaos of a game 163 because that show would have started up on Monday. So one day to sort of catch our breath before going every weekday up until the end of the World Series. But we love it. That's why we do it, because it is the most fun job in the world. If you want to sign up for a subscription to The Athletic to get all the great playoff covers that Ken's going to have, that our entire staff is going to have, you can do that at theathletic.com/baseballshow. You'll get 50% off for your first year. That is going to do it for this episode of The Athletic Baseball Show. For Ken Rosenthal, I am Derek Van Riper. The Athletic Baseball Show returns on Tuesday with Starkville. Have a great day.